Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levin.
I am your host, Mark Levin, reporting live from a very safe social distance from Washington, D.C. The weather in Washington is very pretty, but what's going on in Washington is quite stormy. If you saw the testimony this morning from Dr. Bright, the doctor who was testifying that he went to the Trump administration time and time again, basically begging them to take the pandemic seriously, begging them to get the N95 masks they needed to get in massive quantities. They didn't have to rely on cheap masks at overpriced sources, begging them to get the reagents ready, the tests ready, and, well, just not being listened to. Now, we know that Dr. Bright is no longer in the administration because he was fired, and he was fired precisely because he was pushing the Trump administration to do the right thing. Basically, the Trump administration, as you know, says that if science says that Trump is wrong, you better go with Trump and ignore the science, even if it means something very dangerous, like the drug hydroxychloroquine, which kills you. But, hey, Trump's pushing it because his friend Rudy Giuliani's pushing it, probably because he's making some money off of it. In any case, Dr. Bright is still testifying now with some really brutal, brutal testimony. But that's actually not what I'm here to talk about today. Today's show is a very different show. It's a show where we explore a recent case that is appearing before the United States Supreme Court. And it's actually two cases wrapped up with a number of other things going on where the Trump administration is basically saying that it is above the law. So that's the question for today's show. Is Donald Trump above the law? The Constitution provides all manner of checks and balances, and the Trump administration insists that the rules just don't apply to them. The same checks and balances that applied to George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and every other president up through President Obama just don't apply to Donald Trump. Other presidents obeyed congressional subpoenas. This president will not. Other presidents had to turn over materials in criminal investigations. This president will not. Other presidents were subject to criminal investigations, like Richard Nixon, when all his friends were indicted for the crime, the cover-up that Richard Nixon did in Watergate. Had to turn over the tapes, 9-0 court decision. This president says he doesn't have to obey the 9-0 opinion in U.S. v. Nixon. Then, of course, there's the famous Paula Jones v. Clinton case. I'm not even sure the court came down correctly in that case. It was a 9-0 case that said that anyone in America can sue the President of the United States and force the President of the United States to sit under oath and answer detailed questions about every sexual act they've ever committed. But the Supreme Court held in Clinton v. Jones, and frankly, again, I'm not so sure it made the right decision, but held that a president is subject to a civil lawsuit for things that happened before his time in office, and yes, has to even answer under oath in a deposition all manner of detailed questions relating to every sexual act he's ever had. So that's the precedent coming into this case. That's the precedent coming into Donald Trump land, a precedent where the president is not above the law, is held to action for criminal for crimes, for alleged crimes, and for civil behavior. That was the law. These were 9-0 precedents. So what's going on with Donald Trump? Well, Trump is violating the law in every which way, right? There's the criminal law, the question of whether or not Donald Trump is committing money laundering, tax fraud. Now, these relate to his businesses. They do not relate to conduct while in office. We've talked about conduct while in office. We've talked about trying to rig the elections on behalf of, trying to use American taxpayer dollars to rig the elections, to force or bribe the president of Ukraine to make up dirt about Joe Biden, and using hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money going to weapons, defending Ukraine from Russia to do that. That's actually not what we're talking about. We're not talking about official conduct of Donald Trump while in office. That's something that's clearly impeachable. And indeed, as you know, my view was the president should have been impeached and removed from office. Now, these relates to crimes Donald Trump committed long before he became president and up to and including while he is president. Whether or not, for example, he defrauded New York State in his tax returns. New York State has a case demanding his tax returns so they can determine, investigate whether or not tax fraud was committed. Not even necessarily by Trump, but by all of the Trump entities. We know, for example, that Trump charities have regularly been found guilty of fraud, of guilty of theft, found liable, forced to shut down, paying fines because Donald Trump uses charities basically to profit for himself. That's already happened. Those investigations have been completed. So these relate to other investigations of Donald Trump and his companies. We know that the House of Representatives wants Donald Trump's tax returns, not just because every president in the past has turned over their tax returns, but because, again, they want to know whether some kind of tax fraud or tax avoidance scheme is going on. And do they need new litigation to stop the president from committing tax fraud? You can go all the way back to the 1920s to Warren G. Harding, arguably the second most corrupt president in the United States after Donald Trump. Warren G. Harding had the Teapot Dome scandal, where a bunch of people working in his presidency, I think there were some cabinet officers as well, got involved in a scheme involving an oil company at Teapot Dome. And that scheme involving bribing officials to get benefits, heck, today would just be considered, I think, ordinary course of business. But back then in the 1920s, 100 years ago, they considered bribery to be wrong. They actually opposed it. They actually think you shouldn't be able to pay the president to get a law that favors that company. It was a massive scandal, the Teapot Dome scandal. Congress asked the president, Warren G. Harding, to turn over his tax returns. Harding refused. There was no law at that point. So after Warren Harding died, Congress passed a law to require anyone who has a tax return to disclose it over to the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee of the House of Representatives. Today, it's Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts. But that has been the law now for well nigh 100 years. Never before has it ever not been complied with. That's just two cases, my friend. Then there's the case of Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn, the presidential toady who pled guilty to the crime, serious crimes, of lying to the FBI so that he wouldn't be charged with more serious crimes like treason, like turning over secret documents to the Russians, things for which, let's face it, other Americans have been hanged. And he said only that he merely lied to the FBI. He pled guilty to it. He was convicted of it. He apologized for it. This was all under Mueller's investigation. And now that Mueller's out of the picture, the new toady Attorney General, Bill Barr, for Donald Trump says, oh, even though he's admitted and confessed to the crime, we're not going to prosecute. We'll talk about that case. We'll also talk about the emoluments cases. They're also coming up. Also a question of whether Donald Trump is above the law. The emoluments clauses of the Constitution say, of course, that the president, and really any public official, any federal public official, can't take gifts, can't take money, contributions, can't take emoluments, which is a fancy word for gift, from any foreign government or state or king. And yet Donald Trump is collecting millions, probably more like hundreds of millions of dollars, from the Saudis and other governments to stay in his hotels they didn't used to stay in until Trump was president. Can that case proceed forward? All of these cases raise one simple question. Is the president above the law or not? Can he commit money laundering when no other citizen can? Can he commit tax fraud when no other citizen can? Can he violate the Emoluments Clause, which is so old it predates the Bill of Rights. It's in the original Constitution. Can he do that? Remember, the founders were very, very nervous about bribery. Can he do worse than Nixon? Nixon got in trouble for his Saturday Night Massacre when he fired the special prosecutor who was bearing down hard in this case. Can he simply set all his goons free, whether it's Roger Stone or Mike Flynn? All of these cases are coming to a head right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about each of these cases and even play oral argument from Supreme Court arguments that occurred just yesterday. Don't miss it. We'll be right back right after this.
Never confuse Mark Levin with right-winger Mark Levin. The second E stands for empathy, which the other Mark lacks. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levin.
I am your host, Mark Levin, reporting live a safe social distance from Washington, D.C., where some really interesting things are going on. Again, a very interesting hearing today, Dr. Rick Bright talking about how he tried to warn the Trump administration that the pandemic was a big deal and that maybe we should do something to prepare for it. But that's not the story today. I've actually talked a lot about that in the past few weeks. Now, my story today is whether or not Donald Trump is above the law. Are there any checks and balances? The United States Constitution, the founders jealously put in checks and balances. When I say jealously, I mean they understood, particularly James Madison writes about this, that every single government branch needs to watch the other. This was something basic that you learn in your social studies class, right? You heard of three co-equal bodies of government. The U.S. Congress is actually the first and most important body of government. That's Article 1. Article 2 is the President of the United States. Article 3 is the Supreme Court. And the goal of, and again, this is something you should have learned in eighth grade, the goal of each branch of government is to jealously guard and watch the others to make sure they don't get out of control, right? Congress passes a law, the president can veto that law. Congress, the Senate, gets to decide who gets to sit on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can declare laws of Congress unconstitutional. Congress can overturn a veto with a two-thirds vote in each house and can impeach the president of the United States. The president chooses members of the court, but the president has to follow the law dictated by the Supreme Court. Each and every branch in jealous power, each in pursuing their own power, protects against the others getting out of order. Really, when you think about it, checks and balances is a lot like driving in your lane on the freeway, right? We want to let people change lanes because if everyone stayed in the exact same lane and that lane was really slow or there was an accident in that lane, we wouldn't get anywhere. And yet, you don't want to change lanes when another car's there. You're going to get in a crash, nor do you want to ride on two lanes at once. So by each car protecting its own interest, I want to get there faster. I move the whole process along. But if one car gets the road and everyone else has to stop and wait, you're going to be in a traffic jam for a long time. Well, that's the heart of the checks and balances system at the federal level. But that's actually not the only check and balance in our system. The founders, for all their racism and slavery and, you know, genocide of Native Americans, things they did that were not very cool. They were very cool when it came to designing a system of government. And they recognized that it's not just legislative, executive, and judiciary within the federal government, but also there'd be jealousy and careful power dynamics between the states and the federal government. That's why we had the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution, making clear that the states have ultimate power over everything that's not in the federal Constitution. In fact, the states pre-existed the United States Constitution. And to this day, most criminal law that you violate, that's written by the states. As a state legislator, I am, and those of you who don't know, I'm a delegate, a representative, state representative from the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm well aware of the tremendous power that states have. Get to know your state legislator because she or he may have more control over your life than your member of Congress. We make criminal law. We decide how to fund schools. We decide a lot of transportation. We decide child custody law, right, in a divorce or, you know, murder. Murder. You'd think that'd be a federal crime? Really isn't. Murder is a state crime. So virtually every aspect of your life, of where you go, and then there's local authority as well, and they compete with the states, right? Who has control over the parks? Who has control over a local road? All these systems of government are designed so that we don't have a top-down hierarchy. We are not China. We are not Russia, where you have a dictator in power and then all power flows down. Not at all. Not at all. We are a bunch of squabbling people. Go watch Hamilton, right? We're constantly squabbling, but in our squabbles, right? Look at our whole judicial system, right? We have both sides represented, and then a judge decides. But that can be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if we don't like their ruling, Congress can change the law. And if we don't like their constitutional ruling, we can amend the Constitution or put a new justice on the court. I think I've made my point. Any civics teacher will tell you basic American structure of government is each branch jealously guarding their own power and in the process keeping a watch on all the other branches of government. And what's interesting is that you'll find conservatives used to support the American Constitution. They used to agree with checks and balances. They complained bitterly when Barack Obama said that he wasn't going to prosecute children who came here when they were three from a foreign country without papers. Now, that's a policy decision, and I'm not going to go there now, but we have a strong argument over whether or not there's a presidential power to do that. But they called him a dictator. They called him a tyrant for making that policy choice. How far we have come, how low we have gone, when now we have a president of the United States saying he can be committed crime, never has to be accountable to Congress, that any of his people can break the law at will, and he doesn't even have to obey the courts. Yikes. Both cases are before the United States Supreme Court on Tuesday. We'll be playing them when we come back. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I am your host, Mark Levine. Wondering whether Donald Trump is above the law. Now, you know, that question really, I think, shouldn't be asked, right? It's sort of a maxim of democracy to say no man is above the law. We don't live at a time of the ancient Egyptian pharaohs where we thought that the pharaoh was God himself. Or Louis XIV, who said, L'état, c'est moi, the state, it's me. You know, even King George III. And people need to realize this because, you know, in Hamilton, it's really fun to talk about. Even if you read the founders, King George III, the tyrant, right, in our Declaration of Independence. And he had a tremendous amount of power, no question. But even under King George III, the English Parliament already had power. You know, the idea that the British kings had ultimate power kind of went out with the Magna Carta in 1215. In fact, the English fought a whole civil war in the 1600s over the monarch's power. And by the 1700s, by the time of the American Revolution, there were already clear limits on the monarch's power. For example, the king couldn't go to war without the approval of Parliament. What do you think about that? In the 1700s, we argue today, because the Constitution says that you can't go to war without congressional declaration, and we all know many presidents have wanted to go to war without congressional declaration. But the money, it's all about the appropriation of money. And when the British kings couldn't get the money they wanted, Parliament wouldn't provide it, they couldn't fight the wars they wanted. And that led ultimately to the English Revolution, where the king got his head chopped off. So by the time of King George III, Parliament had real power. And the real power was, if the king wanted to do certain things, the Parliament had to provide the money to do it. And that power is very clearly brought to our Constitution. So Congress has the power of the purse. The president can't just spend money where he wants to. That money has to be appropriated. Did you know that one of the reasons why America won the revolution is, I'm not quite sure what King George III wanted, but Parliament was tired of spending money 6 years in, 7 years in, to fight colonies across the Atlantic. So it wasn't quite our victory at Yorktown. That was part of it, sure. But it was also the fact that Parliament did not want to expend the money. The king had to follow. In the United States Congress, Congress has made clear that it will appropriate no money to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. Now, you may love the wall, you may hate the wall, you may think the wall is useless. count me in that latter category. But the policy question has been decided. Congress said no money. No money, Jack. Donald Trump shut down the government for 2 full months, saying, we're not going to let the government function unless you give me my wall. And Congress said, fine, no government, but no wall. Just doing to the president what the English Parliament did in the 16th and 1700s to the British. So Donald Trump lost. He caved. He surrendered. He said, fine, I'll reopen the government without the wall money. And then he just stole the money and spent it on the wall. Well, you can't do that. Except Donald Trump did. You remember how he did it? He declared a state of emergency. Now, remember, he refused to declare a state of emergency with regard to the pandemic. The pandemic, which has now killed 82,000 Americans and will certainly be in six figures, over 100,000, twice the number of deaths, American deaths in Vietnam over a course of a decade or two, will die in a few months. That wasn't an emergency until mid-March. No. He didn't listen to that. The emergency was, we need a wall that Congress has expressly said you can't have. And lo and behold, Trump judges have said, yes, screw the Constitution. Throw out centuries of British common law. The president can do whatever he wants. It doesn't matter whether Congress appropriates the money or not. The president gets to steal all the money he wants, no matter that Congress says no, and use it however he wants. And barely anyone noticed that hundreds of years of a check and balance was thrown out the window. Then there's the emoluments case. What's an emolument again? An emolument is in the United States Constitution. An emolument says, got my Constitution. It's hiding under some things. Anyway, I know it by heart. An emolument says that someone holding public trust or office in the United States cannot take a gift, present, or other emolument from a king or a prince or a foreign state. Basically, the founders were very, very concerned about foreign bribery. They were concerned that their president would be under the control of England or France or Spain or one of the great nations of the time. So they did not want someone under the spell of a foreign power, whether that power was blackmailing them, maybe, or otherwise had businesses at the Hotel Moscow. I digress. My point is, any foreign gift or emolument is banned under the Constitution. Absolutely banned. This isn't even a law. This isn't even a congressional law to ignore. This is the express language of the Constitution. And when Donald Trump was saying, hey, I'll meet with you, foreign Saudi princes, if you give me hundreds of millions of dollars, which I consider to be a bribe. But forget the bribe. It's a foreign gift, right? If they stay in his hotels and pay way out of market rates, and they were not staying there before Trump was president, they're doing it to buy the president. And Donald Trump said, fine, buy me. And of course, our president's been very nice to the Saudis, even when they killed, murdered, dismembered a Washington Post reporter in the Turkish embassy. So the state's attorney generals have sued to say, hey, we want to investigate these emoluments. We want to see what the quid pro quo was. We want to know how much money the Trump organization, how many hundreds of millions of dollars the Trump organization has made off of Donald Trump being president and taking all these foreign gifts. And one Trumpist court said, nope, sorry. Yeah, it's in the Constitution. We don't follow the Constitution. We say Heil Trump, right? We don't pledge an oath to the Constitution. Well, they didn't quite put it that way. But they basically said, yeah, we're not going to enforce the Constitution. Whatever Donald Trump says goes. Somehow I don't think they would have ruled the same way against President Obama. One of the things to remember in this case, hey, if you're a Republican, remember this, is that the law is not supposed to be that a Democratic president gets one thing and a Republican president gets something else. When you are removing the structure of government, when you are saying that the president is not king, but dictator, more powerful than King George III, you're weakening the system for the future. And so now when President Biden is there, or President, choose your horrible, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, what Democrat scares you the most, right? When President Nancy Pelosi is in power, she can do whatever she wants, and she can spend whatever she wants. She doesn't need congressional appropriation. She can take gifts from whatever country she wants and favor that country. That's the Emoluments Clause. She can commit crimes. as many crimes as she wants. Let's say President Biden. Joe Biden can commit whatever crime he wants. And if one of his toadies gets in trouble, well, that's the Mike Flynn case, right? That's the Roger Stone case, where the president can says, nope, you can't investigate me. You can't investigate any of my friends. You can't even run an investigation. Criminals get to run free and do what they want. And maybe when I'm no longer president, you can investigate if the statute of limitations haven't run, because you know for crimes, if you don't prosecute a certain number of years, those cases go away. Now, that's expressly what the court found was not the law in United States v. Nixon. It's exactly what Nixon said. Nixon said, hey, you know, I'm above the law. I'm busy. I'm president. Don't bother me. And I'm not going to turn over my papers. And, well, the Supreme Court ruled 9-0. Nope, turn over those tapes. We have a right to know whether you're engaged in a cover-up. So fast forward. What was the Supreme Court's cases about yesterday? There were two of them. One was a congressional subpoena for Donald Trump's tax returns. And one was a subpoena of New York state government for Donald Trump's tax returns. Now, again, since the 1970s, for 50 years now, every president's turned over their tax returns. But, and there's this law dating back 100 years, a century, going back to President Warren G. Harding, saying Congress has the right to look at their tax returns. This was never in dispute before, because no president said, I'm not going to disclose my tax returns. And now you have both federal and state officials demanding to see them. Well, the argument, one argument that Republicans are making, is this is burdensome. Oh my God, it's such a big deal. I don't know about you. I got my tax returns right here. Boom. I can turn them over. But it's burdensome. It's burdensome. Well, you know, no one really wants an audit. I don't know that Donald Trump was ever audited. Remember, he was going to turn over his papers when his taxes, when the audit was finished, even though there was no evidence that even an audit existed. Remember that lie? It's hard to lose track of all those lies. But it's not even to Donald. It's going to his accountant. It's going to his bank. It's not burdensome at all. He doesn't have to produce the documents. I'm sure Donald Trump doesn't understand his own tax returns. That's fine. His accountant does. And they're ready to turn it over. But Donald Trump said, no, please don't let them see my tax returns. Well, I don't know. If you got nothing to hide, every other president's done it. But the argument is more than burden, because they know that it's kind of a silly argument. You know what's a lot more burdensome than turning over your tax returns? Being asked under oath on video all the times you cheated on your wife, and in detail, what were the sexual positions? Where did you put your cigar, sir, of the President of the United States? I think that's a lot worse. And what I want you to hear in the back and forth between the justices of the Supreme Court and the presidential lawyer, Jay Sekulow, as they say to him, as Jay Sekulow says, no, the president is immune from all of this. He doesn't have to worry about taxes and civil law and state law while he's president. He can worry about that after he's no longer president. And the justices are saying, now, wait a minute. We ruled 9-0 in Clinton v. Jones that Bill Clinton, by the way, was arguing the same thing. He said, hey, you know, this crazy woman suing me. Remember, she lost below. She lost her case. This crazy woman suing me. I don't want to be involved in this. I will toll the statutes. We'll deal with Paula Jones after I'm no longer president. I have to admit, I didn't think that was particularly unreasonable. There wasn't a crime being committed. This wasn't a state, you know, prosecuting him for some kind of crime. This wasn't Congress trying to decide whether to do a law. This was one woman. And remember, any person in the United States can file a suit against anyone for anything. All 300 million of us can file a lawsuit against Donald Trump right now, we want to, for anything, whether true or false. I felt that that kind of thing may well be burdensome for the president, but whatever. Supreme Court ruled 9-0, no, Mark, you're wrong. The president's not above the law. He's got to follow civil, and he's got to follow criminal procedure. So when we come back, I want to play some of that Supreme Court argument that we heard Tuesday and listen to the presidential attorney try to distinguish why tax returns are too burdensome, but a detailed accounting of every sexual act you've ever committed, that's just fine. Just fine. We'll be right back after this.
He's a Harvard economist and a Yale lawyer. He does not keep up with the Kardashians. He's Mark Levin.
Thank you.
back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
I sat through 3 hours of Supreme Court argument on Tuesday. I heard every word, every justice in the two separate cases that are really the heart of it is to get Donald Trump's tax returns. One is the House of Representatives doing it, Congress doing it. And this, the case you're going to hear from now is the state prosecutor, the state attorney general of New York, saying he wants to get these documents. Now, what's amazing is that Jay Sekulow, the president's attorney, is saying, no, the president's immune. He's immune as long as he is in office. And he doesn't have to turn over these documents because, oh, my God, there's 2,300 district attorneys all across the nation that could ask for things. To which the right response is, well, there are 300 million people who could sue the president. How could Paula Jones sue Bill Clinton, but Donald Trump not have to respond to the attorney general of the state of New York? The district attorney for the District of Manhattan. Listen to some of this exchange. The first is Jay Sekulow, the counsel for the president.
He has responsibilities. He is himself a branch of government. He is the only individual that is a branch of government in our federal system. So our position is that the Constitution itself, both in structure and text, supports the position that the president would be temporarily immune from this activity, from a state proceeding, while he is the president of the United States.
Justice Breyer?
Every man's evidence excludes the president.
Justice Ginsburg saying that every man's evidence is not that it excludes the president.
The president is not to be treated as an ordinary citizen, and this is a temporary immunity. This is for while the president's in office, and we think that is required by the Constitution. Thank you.
Justice Breyer?
Well, you make a point of the 2,300 district attorneys, but of course, in Clinton v. Jones, there might be a million, I don't know, tens of thousands of people who might bring lawsuits. Perhaps all of them were unfounded, but they could file the paper. Why isn't it sufficient just to apply ordinary standards? I gather ordinarily, any person gets a subpoena can come in and say it's unduly burdensome. And what counts as unduly burdensome for a doctor who's in the middle of an operation might be very different from a person who's a salesman. And similarly for the president, all the factors you raise could come in under the title unduly burdensome. So why not just go back? Let the president say, I'll show you precisely how this is burdensome. I'm going to spend time, effort, working all these things out, figuring out what they mean, etc. And if he shows undue burden and lack of connection, he wins, and otherwise not. That's true of every person. That's Clinton v. Jones. Why not the same here?
Justice Breyer, the hypothetical you just gave, I think, proves the point. By the time you were to prepare, review, analyze the various requests, just in these three cases that we have today, shows the burdensome nature. And then to require the president of the United States, and as you raised in your opinion, in a concurring opinion in Clinton versus Jones, that burden is being met just by us being here. But to require the president to have to respond to each and every state district attorney that would like
no,
to...
No, he would hire you, and he'd hire a lawyer to list what the burdens are. That wouldn't take a lot of time. And then he wouldn't be burdened because you'd go in and say what the burdens are. And if you're right, you win that case. They are saying the other side, there are no burdens here.
Well,
you say there are. So send it back and let them figure out what they are.
I think doing that establishes the problem with an analysis of a case-by-case analysis. For instance, in this very case, in this subpoena found on page 118A and 19 of the petition appendix, there's a list of documents that are extensive. You would have to meet with the president of the United States. I mean, could you imagine just for a moment, Justice Breyer, that I, and you said he, let's assume the president were to hire me, that I'm going to call the president of the United States today and say, I know you're handling a pandemic right now for the United States, but I need to spend a couple of 2 to 3 hours with you going over a subpoena of documents that are wanted by here, the New York County District Attorney.
Oh, my God. Jay Sekulow. Donald Trump doesn't even get into the office till noon every day. He spends from 5 a.m. This is his aide saying this. From 5 a.m., he gets up early in the morning. He watches TV until noon and spends his time watching TV, eating, and tweeting. And you're afraid of 2 to 3 hours? Do you know how often he played golf? He spent more time at Mar-a-Lago than he did at the White House. 2 to 3 hours. Do you think Bill Clinton spent more than 2 to 3 hours, I don't know, on the Paula Jones case? Continue.
I know you're busy, but can you carve me out 2 hours?
Justice Alito?
Are there at least some circumstances in which the U.S. Constitution would permit a local prosecutor to subpoena records containing information about a sitting president? So think of this situation. Suppose that the prosecutor has good reason to believe that the records contain information that is not available from any other source about whether a third party committed a crime. And suppose that waiting until the end of the president's term would make the prosecution of that crime impossible or at least very difficult. Would you say that at least in that circumstance, it would be permissible for the grand jury subpoena to be enforced?
In a state court proceeding, the issues of time and burden are still there. Now, in U.S. v. Nixon, that was a case where the president was a witness and the documents were asked for and this court said it should be handed over. But in that case, it was very clear that the president was a witness and the attorney, the independent counsel there, Leon Jaworski, specifically stated to this court that the president was not a target. So if we had a pure witness standpoint, while it's a different case, the same constitutional principles would be at play. But here we're talking about criminal process.
Wait, Jay, you're saying, hold on. You're saying if the president is not a target, if the president hasn't done criminal behavior, he can be examined. But if he is a criminal, if he's a crook, if he's stolen all this money and committed crimes, we can't investigate? Jay, really got to get your argument straight. We'll examine this more next week. This is Mark Levine signing off.